Epilogue. Susanna Martin's laughter was a clarion of reason, echoing through the court. One can only imagine how the villagers reacted to this little act of defiance from the accused. To see these poor, afflicted girls, writhing and wailing, openly mocked in a court of law by their victimizer, was too much for the magistrates to bear. Perhaps it was Martin's laughter that sealed her fate. Salem had been drawn into a pseudo-reality that few dared to question. With every absurdity accepted by the good people of the village, what else could Martin do but laugh? She had attempted the rational approach to no avail. Why was it, she reasoned, that the girl's claims to have seen various disembodied spectral images of villagers were taken as proof of their guilt? As she said to the judges, "He that appeared in the shape of Samuel, a glorified saint, may appear in anyone's shape." By invoking the biblical story of the Witch of Endor, she was reminding them that the devil can take any form he pleases, including those of the faithful. Her logic was impeccable, and so it had to be ignored so that the illusion could be sustained. The power of the accusers was absolute. As John Proctor says in The Crucible, "The little crazy children are jangling the keys of the kingdom, safe in the knowledge that those who cross them will be the next to be condemned." Although Susanna Martin did not escape the hangman's noose, her laughter may have sown the seeds of doubt in the minds of her fellow villagers. The new Puritans also deserved to be laughed out of existence. Critical social justice is every bit as mirthless as the Christianity it has usurped. But to mock its high priests is to make an enemy of martinets who will happily lie and smear and bully their way to victory. For all that, the escape routes from hysteria are available should we wish to take them. This is no easy feat. Many who have found themselves on the receiving end of cancel culture have been helpless to prevent the obliteration of their reputations and careers. Those who have been first to challenge the false reality promoted by the New Puritans have paid a considerable price, and others will continue to do so. But there will come a point at which the numbers are too great to be ignored. To uphold liberal values has become a risky endeavour, but it is only the silence of the majority that makes it so. Even after his experiences in the Soviet gulags, Alexander Solzhenitsyn was able to reflect on the possibility that, had more people spoken out, the atrocities might have been avoided. "So why did I keep silent?" he asks. Every man always has handy a dozen glib little reasons why he is right not to sacrifice himself. 20 innocent people lost their lives in the Salem witch hunts, but by the end of 1692, this short-lived spate of madness was almost at an end. Too many prominent citizens had been accused, and the cost of sustaining the fantasy for those in power became too great. Arguably, the process began when some of the girls accused the Reverend Samuel Willard, a highly respected minister of the Old South Church of Boston, possibly due to his known scepticism about the admissibility of spectral evidence. As one who had adjured caution against taking the words of the accusers as confirmation of another's guilt, he represented a direct threat to the girls and their credibility. However, by crying out on such an esteemed figure as Willard, the acting president of Harvard College no less, the accusers had made a grave error. Faced with such audacity, the judges were surely jolted back into the real world, if only momentarily. They gently corrected the girls, assuring them that they must have made a mistake. Perhaps they had confused the Reverend Samuel Willard with Constable John Willard, who was already in prison awaiting execution for witchcraft. But if the girls were fallible, and if the identities of their tormentors could be so easily confused, what was the implication for those who had already been convicted? Nor was Willard the only example of this kind. When Judge Jonathan Corwin's mother-in-law was repeatedly implicated, no arrests were carried out. Nor was any action taken when the wife of William Phipps, the colony's governor, was identified as a witch. The most telling example was when the girls cried out on an esteemed gentleman in Andover, who promptly issued a writ to arrest these accusers in £1,000 action of defamation. threatened with legal consequences by a man who had the wherewithal to carry it through, the accusers quickly turned their attention elsewhere. If God was indeed on their side, it would seem they found the forces of Mammon more intimidating. Could it be, then, that many of the accusers, magistrates, and ministers knew that they were complicit in a mass delusion? How else might they explain the sudden silence of the accusers when threatened with a lawsuit? Had they been bewitched only temporarily? Or could it be that the Prince of Darkness, the Archfiend, Hell's Dread Emperor, the antagonist of heaven, the infernal serpent whose mighty form recalled the Titans who warred on Jove, the false dissembler who erected pandemonium upon the burning Marl, would scurry away at the slightest whiff of litigation? One suspects that the magistrates and ministers of Salem had succumbed to what the economist Tim O'Curran calls preference falsification, by which the opinions one expresses are more closely aligned to societal expectations than authentic feelings. If so, then those in authority were only partially committed to the make-believe world they had helped to sustain. All the convictions had come about due to a reliance on spectral evidence. Without the visions of the girls, there was nothing left to justify the verdicts. It was the girls' lived experience that damned the accused, and anyone who expressed scepticism was inviting the spotlight of suspicion to fall upon them. Until, that is, Joseph Dudley, Deputy Governor of Massachusetts, drew up a list of 8 questions concerning the witchcraft trials and sent them to some of the most prominent ministers in the colony. He had asked whether spectral evidence could be trusted. "By no means," came the response. Once these fresh standards were applied, all ongoing prosecutions for malefic witchcraft instantaneously collapsed. The magistrates had assumed that Satan could not mimic the form of an innocent person, and so the shapes that visited the children at night must have been authentic. Susanna Martin's reference to the Witch of Endor in her trial had prompted some of the villagers to reconsider the accuser's testimonies. But now her view had been confirmed by some of the most reputable clergymen in the country. This was the tipping point. The judges had been wrong, and innocent men and women had paid the price. We find ourselves in a similar position with the culture warriors of the present day. While their power often makes it seem as though they represent the consensus, their views have never been shared by the cowed majority. The New Puritans, in other words, rely on our complicity to keep us as their marionettes, but cutting the strings would doubtless conduce to a healthier society. Self-censorship is always a choice, even when the consequences for speaking our minds can be dire. The story of Salem can be considered a microcosm of a culture that is learning to draw itself out of a collective delusion. The first to speak out are invariably the casualties, but their sacrifice lessens the risk for those who follow. Ultimately, even those who are most responsible for perpetuating the fantasy come to their senses. With any luck, it will be the same with the New Puritanism. It is my wish, in other words, that within a generation this book will be obsolete. The few who remain with any interest in perusing these pages will, I hope, smile and shake their heads at the bubble of absurdities that enveloped us in the first few decades of the millennium. They will vaguely recall those outlandish years when verifiable truths were ignored or denied, when a few powerful cliques attempted to sabotage our educational and political systems, and when we were all expected to parrot the same shibboleths to appease this obnoxious elite. And to think, they might reflect, authors wasted their time writing whole books about such nonsense, only to see it dissipate like every other ephemeral trend. Did they really think these unhappy few could reset the clock to year zero? That they might raise our civilization to a heap of broken images? While liberals call for progress, the New Puritans call for change. The distinction is worth noting. I am optimistic that social liberalism will win out. The alternative is too grim to contemplate. Of course, I do not discount the possibility that the damage is irreparable, but the liberal project has done more to promote equality and freedom than any other in human history. It would surely be unwise to allow it to be derailed without a fight. Solzhenitsyn's writings remind us that it is worth speaking out even in the midst of hopelessness, not least so that we can say we made the attempt. Wasn't it Saint Denis who carried his head for many miles after it was severed from his body? I admire that kind of tenacity. Our challenge lies in restoring the need for nuance, but this will not be easy when so many of the new Puritans cannot see that objections to their creed are rooted in liberal values. Where we hear reason and dispute, they hear the barking of Satan's hordes. Of course, this in itself is overly simplistic. For all the collectivism and pigeonholing of human experience that we see from the high priests of critical social justice, those who have succumbed to these new orthodoxies cannot be dismissed as a monolithic group, incapable of individual thoughts and responses. Like any congregation, some have been wholly transfixed by the preacher's words, while others retain some reservations. The most militant and doctrinaire are not representative. They are merely those whose voices reverberate with greater force. It is in the lacunae of doubt that reason can find a way to penetrate, even when widespread institutional capture has generated the illusion of a society that has lost its mind. In all of this, we need to remember why we were dragged into this culture war in the first place, and to communicate the key points with clarity and civility. To oppose the new Puritans is to be concerned about an inherently divisive ideology whose natural terminus is segregation according to race, gender, and sexuality. It is to be concerned about a worldview based on the faith of intersectionality, which pits minority groups against each other in ever more elaborate hierarchies of privilege. It is to be concerned about how many of those who believe themselves to be on the right side of history are increasingly intolerant of viewpoints that do not precisely match their own, and have no compunction about bullying, demonizing, and threatening those who step out of line. It is to be concerned about those who claim the power to intuit the secret motives of others, who interpret their detractors' words in the most uncharitable possible way, and who consider all forms of dissent as an expression of evil. It is to be concerned about the way in which terms such as racist, white supremacist, homophobe, transphobe, fascist, and Nazi have been rendered virtually meaningless through continual misapplication, and how even liberals and left-wingers are now routinely mischaracterized as far-right for the slightest point of disagreement. In short, it is to resist the ongoing infantilism of public discourse. It is always possible, of course, that the new Puritanism will self-destruct. I have pointed out that their nature is cannibalistic, and with every progressive figure they assail, they further alienate the doubters within their clan. When activists turned on the poet Kate Clancy, whose progressive credentials could not be better established, many were awoken to their essentially destructive worldview. Her award-winning book, Some Kids I Taught and What They Taught Me, 2019, led to accusations of racism and ableism for some of the depictions of minorities. Those described in the book were quick to defend Clancy, asserting her unequivocal care and support for them. As usual, the new Puritans had claimed to be offended on other people's behalf, and the victims were having none of it. After Clancy agreed to rewrite the book following consultation with sensitivity readers, there were further objections. A spokesperson from Picador, the imprint of Pan Macmillan which had published Clancy's book, issued a statement that included a future commitment to recognise his privileged position as a white, middle-class gatekeeper. As Sonia Sodha noted in The Observer, this very much read like a hostage note. As a writer with a high profile who has supported young people from marginalised communities, Clancy seems like the least likely target for excommunication. To an extent, the move has backfired. Her case is one of many which has prompted those normally sympathetic to the New Puritans and their various causes to think again. For all their posturing as guardians of public morality, such activists have been exposed as both fallible and cruel. Increasingly, their followers are beginning to understand that such hypocrisy fatally undermines their expectations of moral purity. These occasional struggle sessions might have the desired impact of dissuading other would-be heretics from straying from the approved course, but they also serve as a reminder that to be one of the faithful is no guarantee of protection. The New Puritans are particularly severe in their treatment of apostates, or of those within their ranks who fail to uphold their impossible standards. The girls of Salem achieved fame and power through their roles as the persecuted saviours of the community, but they also created what Marion L. Starkey describes as a little lifeless vacuum about them wherever they moved. Few would dare to associate with them either during or after the trial, and once the mania had subsided, they were no longer trusted by their peers. At time of writing, the New Puritans are very possibly at the apotheosis of their power, but who would seek them out as friends? They can only associate with the like-minded because they are so feared, which is one reason why the echo chamber effect is self-perpetuating. In the absence of those who would challenge their beliefs in any way, they must always relapse into their joyless fantasy. As Lady Caroline Lamb said of Byron, they are mad, bad, and dangerous to know. In November of 1692, a soldier in the city of Gloucester in Massachusetts became convinced that his sister had fallen under the influence of witches. The girls from Salem were duly called to verify the presence of Satan, but on their journey something unexpected occurred. As they crossed the Ipswich Bridge, they passed by an elderly woman. Almost by instinct, the girls broke into convulsions and cried out their usual accusations of sorcery. But the passers-by simply ignored them or moved away. Without an audience to validate their cries, the girls had little choice but to fall silent and resume their journey. After this remarkable event, it is said that the girls made no further accusations. This is our Ipswich Bridge moment. While those in authority continue to heed the cries of the New Puritans, our society will continue to be dominated by the witches of their imaginations. If we continue to indulge them, we make ourselves party to their collective delusions. Starkey rightly observes that the half-truth is the most dangerous of falsehoods. And while we are right to be alert to the ongoing injustices in society, we would be unwise to give too much credit to those who exaggerate them for their own ends. As the New Puritans gain momentum and their power over us increases, it will become apparent that to ignore them will only guarantee their ongoing dominance. They will continue to deny biological reality and threaten you if you will not acquiesce. They will tell you that the kind of colour blindness advanced by Martin Luther King is a form of racism, rather than an exquisite goal worth pursuing. They will bully people in the name of compassion, promote division and call it progressive, and rehabilitate a new form of racism under the guise of tolerance. They will insist on fabricating realities that correspond with their emotional states and couch their nebulous theories in fustian and obfuscation. They will use inflammatory language to misrepresent your concerns, accuse you of erasing people's existence or committing acts of violence through speech. They will claim that there is no such thing as objective truth, but demand that you acknowledge the truth of their lived experience. They will carry on feeding the far right by elevating identity politics and claim to be opposing fascism through their authoritarian methods. And if you dare to suggest that any of their demands should be subject to discussion or debate, they will not hesitate to brand you a bigot. When this happens, it is our responsibility to resist and restate the case for liberal values. It will be a long, uncomfortable, but necessary process, like the setting of a broken bone. Along the way, we should defend those who are the targets of bullying campaigns, whether they are being attacked for what they have said or what they refuse to say. We should not allow ourselves to be intimidated by threats, insults, and false accusations. We should reclaim the courage to think for ourselves, as encapsulated in Horace's phrase, sapere aude, dare to know, which Kant appropriated as the motto of the Enlightenment. The desire for a quiet life is entirely understandable, but surely We have reached the point where the keys of the kingdom must be wrenched back from the hands of the crazy children.